House Speaker Joe Suki's resignation from office in response to allegations of sexual misconduct is part of an agreement with the State Ethics Commission, which is holding a news conference a little over an hour from now. Our government reporter Wayne Yoshioka will be there. He's on the line with us now from the Capitol. Good morning, Wayne.
Hi, Chris. Actually, I'm outside of the American Savings Building, which is the where the Hawaii State Ethics Commission office is. I was at the Capitol earlier this morning. They have a lot of things going on. It's Aviation Day. It's Early Childhood Education Day. And they also have tobacco opponents rallying at various committee meetings. So it's kind of noisy there, so I figured I'd stay here and talk to you from the American Savings Building.
Well, makes sense, Wayne. What was the mood at the Capitol? You know, this is a shocker, right?
Some women legislators, mm-hmm. they said the definitely the work culture has shifted, and I guess House Speaker Emeritus Joe Suki was a victim of not recognizing that the work culture had shifted. And they said, you know, it's really sad for everyone, but it's a better moment. It's a teaching moment for all of the younger people entering the job market, as well as the older people who have been around a while, that, you know, it serves them notice that the work culture has shifted and it's different than it is today. And there is no tolerance for sexual harassment.
Well, Wayne, what with one of the things that we saw with Speaker Emeritus's story is that a single allegation kind of started, kind of triggered further allegations. And that's the new information that has emerged today. Is there a sense that there's more to come, maybe from some other areas at the Capitol?
I don't know about that. That's hard to measure, because I think, you know, the House Speaker is such an important and powerful position in terms of budget as well as policy. And it's really an inverse relationship for someone going to the Speaker of the House and asking, you know, passage of a bill, altering a policy or whatever. It's a power imbalance. So I think there are a lot of people that said, you know, we're just not going to say anything and suck it up. But I think when former DHS Director Rachel Wong came out, it empowered them to say, you know, it's time that we spoke about this and get this out in the public.
That's what seems to be going on, Wayne. Thanks very much for checking in with us.
All right.
That was Wayne Yoshioka, HPR's political reporter.
Now we go to Honolulu Civil Beat for more on the developing story of Representative Suki's admission of sexual misconduct. Chad Blair is Honolulu Civil Beat's political and opinion editor. Good morning, Chad.
Hi, Catherine.
So your staff was able to actually talk directly to some of the other women involved in this case.
That's right. And Anita Hofschneider, our reporter who broke the story, cannot be with us this morning, because not only is there that press conference at 12:30 today that Wayne mentioned regarding the State Ethics Commission, there's actually a press conference before that. As we speak, Michael Green, the attorney for Joe Suki, and apparently the Speaker Emeritus will be there too. So there will be more news coming out of that. But Anita did speak with several people. Anonymity was granted so they could speak freely. As Wayne mentioned, only Rachel Wong has come forward. I would just echo, however, what Chris was leading to. This suggests that the Me Too movement has come to Hawaii's shores, and I agree that it will probably embolden others to come out. But the things that Anita was hearing, and they're in our story today, are disturbing, and they are things that the speaker has admitted to, the former speaker. That is what is in the Ethics Commission's investigation: inappropriate touching and kissing, making remarks, saying comments, talking about physical appearance, things that exceeded the boundary of a what we call the aloha kiss or spirit here in the islands.
Right, and I think, you know, that was significant. I mean, really, for him to admit, yes, he went beyond that aloha kiss.
I think another thing that's significant, and kudos again to Anita for reporting this. This is another story that we have on the site. There actually is no, ironically, any complaints that need to be made to the House go directly to the Speaker. And what if the Speaker himself or herself is actually the subject of those complaints? There's nothing procedural-wise she found out what to do about that. Anita did talk to House leaders and said, well, I guess it would go to the Vice Speaker to consider this. But that's one reason Rachel Wong went to the Ethics Commission, apparently could not go to the Speaker himself with these terrible allegations. So that's something that Scott Psyche, the current House Speaker, is saying, look, they're looking at their policies, they're going to review it, they're emphasizing training on sexual harassment and abuse. All indications are that they're going to try and make this more than a teachable moment, something to hopefully prevent this from happening again, or certainly having procedures for women or men to feel that they can come forth and talk about these things.
You know, and that's really important because we had the same discussion with folks from the Hotel Workers Union, Local 5, where a particular hotel where the person you had to, you know, bring up the allegations with, that person was the abuser. And so very difficult situation, but yeah, surprisingly, apparently commonplace. So obviously there has to be some other system in place.
I think so, too. You know, the words open secret, Mr. Psyche's habits, the ones he has now admitted to, everyone, many people knew at the Capitol, involving staffers, involving lobbyists, even journalists. I think we may be seeing more cases come forward. We'll probably know more after we hear from the press conferences today.
You're probably right. All right. Thanks, Chad.
Thanks, Catherine.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Honolulu Civil Beat, today featuring political and opinion editor Chad Belair. To read the full story, visit civilbeat.org. Complaints about junk cars in neighborhoods across the state hit a crescendo last year. The eyesore threw light on a dilemma between the city and military over automobiles left behind by service members. State lawmakers have been hearing measures to try and solve the eyesore complaints. One bill to require removal of cars within 10 days is getting pushback from the counties. The real issue is lack of space to store derelict and abandoned vehicles. City Director of Customer Service Services, Sherry Kajiwara, explains why it makes a difference between the two.
Abandoned cars is like the larger set. Derelict is like a subset of abandoned cars. So for a car to be deemed a derelict right now, it has to have expired tags of about 2 years. It has to be missing a major component, and the owner can't be located or no one's claiming ownership of the vehicle.
When you're saying component, like missing the wheels and the doors?
Or the engine or any component that makes it inoperable.
So how do these derelict cars end up on the side of the road? Because, you know, we're seeing so many of them.
Right. We you know, we're kind of like in this perfect storm, Catherine, because one of the issues about abandoned vehicles is more people are doing it and trying to find out why. I understand, and don't quote me on the numbers, but I was told that the price of recycled steel was about $120 a ton. And a car would weigh, let's estimate, about a ton. So if you chose to take your unwanted vehicle in and get some money from it for it, you probably could get, you know, some good bucks. I understand right now it's $6 a ton. So I think less people, although it's the right thing to do, just like your bulky item, you need to pay to dispose of your own trash. People should be disposing of their unwanted cars, but they're choosing to illegally abandon it and make it taxpayers' problem.
And explain the process. I mean, so if a car is, let's say, you know, found to be abandoned or derelict and it gets towed somewhere, is there a way to track back? So we just say, okay, well, that tow truck picked up this, you know, car, and then and lo and behold, you know, if they picked it up in Kailua, now it's in Waianae. I mean.
Okay, so one of the problems that we are finding is that cars are being abandoned, but we ticket them. So HPD tickets them. Our enforcement officers also have powers to ticket, and they do that as well. But the ticket sometimes never reached the owner, And once we issue a ticket, it's no longer a city issue. It's a state judiciary issue. The follow-up needs to be done by the courts. And I don't have stats as to how many of these tickets they actually follow up on. But I do think that the penalties are not severe enough to deter people from abandoning their cars. I think it's about $100 or $150 as a fee for abandoning a car.
Is there any effort to raise that?
I haven't seen that in the legislature, although there are a lot of bills right now that are being introduced to deal with this problem. And I think seeing some of these things through are really going to help us.
Okay, there's one to require the city and county to remove an abandoned or derelict car within 10 days. I know a lot of the counties don't like it because it does really put a burden on their departments.
Well, to be honest, right now, the city and county has a three-day removal. That's our threshold. And we work every day to try to ensure that our cars are removed from public property within 3 days. Our contractor is given 3 days, or they're assessed a penalty for every day past that. The problem is not that implementing 10 days, I don't think that's going to solve it. The problem is storage, and storage is space. And there are many reasons that affect space. There's no land left to lease for the purpose of storing cars. As the contractor or tow vendors, as their lease comes up for renewal, more and more landowners are taking them away to do other things with their land. Or because of EPA and environmental concerns, people are less apt to rent or lease their land out for the purpose of storing cars.
So in your testimony, I know at the legislature you've asked the state, you know, that's the one thing that could really help solve this problem. And is there any state land to have? Has it been identified?
You know, we asked our contractor to get more land as part of their contract. They kept trying and they kept coming back and saying, we can't. And honestly, I couldn't believe that the effort wasn't there. So we as the city, we decided to step up and find our own land. And we went through almost a year of negotiation with private landowners, state land, all different leads. And we were met with the exact same result. We were unable to rent land. We were unable, even if we were willing to pay good money, we could not find land that people would allow us to use for the purpose of storing cars. It is a problem.
And here on Oahu, do they need to be strategically placed?
Well, here on Oahu, you have environmental issues. So you can't affect a water table. You can't affect certain land use ordinances. There are so many restrictions, and I think that's one of the problems that's making it hard. So with my contractors running out of land to store the cars and the city unable to assist with acquiring state or city land for the purpose, we have to limit the amount of cars we can pick up. It's a space issue.
But if you're saying you pick them up within 3 days, then where are they going?
That's why we have not been picking them up in 3 days, and that's why we actually have not taken the option to fine the vendor for not picking up, because we understand the problem. And again, as I mentioned, that perfect storm, it started about a year and a half ago with the military vehicles, and that became an issue. We had to hold vehicles until they were properly processed according to the Service Members Civil Relief Act. That meant we had to notify the owner. And finding an owner that no longer lives in Hawaii and abandoned his car years ago, that proved very difficult.
Right. And you just recently settled with the Justice Department.
Yes. And they have still held the position that we must contact the owner and get a signed waiver before we do anything with those cars. So since a year and a half ago, we had close to 600 cars stored until the settlement. Now that we've reached settlement, we can start taking action on some of those cars, but it's going to be a while before we get waivers signed or court orders done. But we're left right now with about 248 cars.
Wow, so it's still quite
take
a few.
Space.
Take up space, yeah. And right. So as far as the efforts at the state legislature, are there parcels that maybe folks might have identified, you know, that are under the jurisdiction of the state that we could look at?
Well, under the state and House bill, those two don't address land. They address other issues. But I was very pleased to see that recently, it wasn't a bill, I think more like a resolution, was brought out to urge the Department of Land and Natural Resources to help the city and counties to identify state property that is vacant state property that could be used for this purpose.
Okay.
That's promising.
So that's, but then it's still a ways away. I mean, I know it's March. Session ends in May, so it may still take a few months before anything happens.
Well, I will tell you, Catherine, that behind the scenes, we are continuing to work. We're continuing to work to find a parcel. We had one just almost ready turnkey, then it fell through. Then we had another one just about ready to move cars on, and it fell through. We have another lot that we are looking to hopefully get operational, if I'm lucky, within a few weeks' time. And then I'd like to get all those cars off the street and onto that lot and start processing from the lot rather than from the public roadways.
Right. And is there an issue with maybe these cars just getting towed from one spot to the next?
Well, because of the drop in value of scrap metal, I suspect is no longer lucrative for even businesses that deal with cars as part of their business to scrap it. So we're finding like state trucks or state vehicles that had been auctioned or sold properly, but we don't know how they're ending up on our street. So these are not all vehicles by private citizens. They're coming from somewhere else. And so we're investigating that as well.
But if, let's say, they don't have wheels, somebody is towing them from one location, and then all of a sudden they're just, you know, in another neighborhood.
Right. Unless we catch them in the act, it's hard to say whether they were missing their wheels at the time they were towed or they sat in the street long enough to be stripped down and missed their wheels then. But that is a problem. The longer they sit on the streets, the more of a problem they become to the residents' safety issues, to the environment with leaky oils. And then aesthetically, it's just an eyesore, and I realize that. So we're working really hard to see how we can address this in creative, out-of-the-box solution.
Okay. Anything else that you'd want to underscore about this, because maybe, the public's patience is just, wearing thin.
Right. We need more legislation to stop people from abandoning their vehicles. That's the very bottom line. But the cars that are out there, we need them to opt to turn in their vehicles rather than abandon it. So if you no longer want your vehicle, go to the city's website and look up abandoned vehicle. It's called our junking program. And you fill out the form and you turn in the license plates and your certificate of ownership at a satellite city hall. We give you a form to put on the dashboard or on the driver's seat and we'll come and get it for you. No charge. It's pretty good rather than leaving it out somewhere.
Okay.
But the changes in the legislature are going to help us because right now the definition of a derelict car is so stringent that we must hold it for about a month to allow somebody time to claim it and then auction it and then process it for disposal. The quicker we can call it a derelict, the faster we can dispose of it. So that's going to help us. That's one of the changes that are in the law. They also have removed the requirement to dispose of by auction. So right now I can have a twisted heap of metal, but because the tags are current, I can't scrap that car. I have to go through the 20-day wait period, monthly auction period, and then the destruction process. That might be 2 months. I'm holding a car that I know won't sell.
Right. The delays just add up.
The change is going to help us.
And it adds to people's frustration.
Yes.
And your frustration.
Yes. We want to get rid of those cars because, again, the issue is space. The faster I can process these cars and get them handled, the more space that opens up.
That was Sherry Kajiwara, director of the city's Information and Complaint Office. She's hopeful that the state can help solve a growing problem with junk cars littering our highways and neighborhoods.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, memories of a long-forgotten battlefield. But first, your quiz. Ukaholabe, o Hawaii.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're talking about a group of critically endangered creatures that fall in the category of flagship species. These are species whose presence is an indication of a pristine habitat, free of predators and introduced species. Unfortunately, there aren't that many habitats left in our islands, and these animals are seeing severe population decline. Of 99 endemic species that once thrived in Hawaii, only about 25 remain. Today, they can be found in upland forests above 600 meters elevation. The University of Hawaii has a lab dedicated to the preservation of these critical species. Its website says, "We have a team of dedicated students, technicians, postdoctoral researchers, and interns whose responsibilities include feeding and caring for these unique, extremely rare endemic taxa." Today, we're looking for the name of these slimy creatures, and that's a clue. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaii Life Real Estate Brokers, serving Oahu, Maui, Kauai, and the Big Island of Hawaii. Listings and information at hawaiilife.com.
The Japanese Empire's December 1941 attack on Pearl Harbor was by no means confined to the harbor. It was a carefully planned, well-rehearsed island-wide attack, and most of its battle sites at Hickam Field, Wheeler Army Airfield, Marine Corps Air Station Kaneohe Bay, and Ford Island have long ago been designated as National Historic Landmarks. All except one, Marine Corps Air Station Ewa, one of the first military installations to be hit by the approaching attack force. John Bond is a history buff who has made it his mission to remind us of the battle that raged there the morning of December 7th. He's giving a talk on the subject in Honolulu this Saturday. He's on the line with us now. Good morning, John.
Hi, good morning, Chris. How you doing?
Pretty good. Thanks very much for doing this. And this is a fascinating sort of side story of history, isn't it?
Well, we think it's actually a big story. Goes back 1925, and then all the way through to the Battle of Midway and beyond. Actually, a very large story came out of this airfield, but I could talk a long time about it, so go ahead and just ask me whatever you would like to ask.
Well, what goes back to 1925?
Well, originally it was set up as a mooring mast for the Navy airship program, which was a big thing at the time, but the airships on the main one kept crashing, so they revised the whole program in the 1932. They redesigned the mooring mast, which originally was 160 feet high, a major landmark in Ewa, and they cut it down about two-thirds for the later generation airships. Those, unfortunately, also crashed, so they wound up not getting any airships out here, even though the Germans planned one of their airships to make a world tour and stop it Ewa. They didn't at the time. So anyway, in 1941, it was turned over to the Marines to set up a Marine Corps advanced airfield.
One of the things about the Pearl Harbor attack that isn't always discussed is how effectively the Japanese attacking force neutralized our ability to respond, our air capability, right? The Japanese knocked out a lot of planes without ever allowing them to take off, and thereby preventing an aerial battle over Pearl Harbor. Is that accurate?
Yeah, it's very accurate. The Japanese had a extremely well-planned attack. They had mapped out everything in great detail. They had actually done a lot of pre-air reconnaissance.
Mm-hmm.
There was even we have an air photo of taken by the Japanese that morning of December 7th right over Ewa Field. And so they also took movies of the whole attack going in and out.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were very interested in documenting the whole thing in great detail because they knew it was a significant battle. But the main part that happened was the first wave came through and they took out Wheeler Field, which the aircraft were pursuit fighters, so they wanted to make sure those were taken out.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next hit was Eva Field because they had Marine Wildcat pursuit fighters, and they wanted to make sure those were taken out because the main force actually came right through the Eva plane.
Mm-hmm.
So they wanted to make sure nothing was in the way. So the Japanese had a very good combat air patrol of Zero fighters that really did a precise, excellent job of shooting down everything.
And those aircraft that got neutralized at Eva and at Wheeler would have been a pretty effective response to the Zeros had they been able to get them in the air, right?
Well, actually, that's the great story about Eva Field that most people don't know about, is the major air battles of December 7th actually took place right over Eva Field.
Mm-hmm.
There was many significant battles, including the two guys in the P-40s out of Holly Eva, Taylor and Welch, who flew down and shot down Japanese planes over Eva Field. But the Japanese had previously shot down five Navy dive bombers from the USS Enterprise that were coming in to land at Ford Island.
Mm-hmm.
And people forget about them. They were shot down all over Eva Field, and a couple made emergency landings at the field. And then there was also B-17s coming in from California, and they flew right over Eva Field and got caught up in the air attack. So there was actually a very large air battle that went on over Eva Field, all totally forgotten.
Well, yeah, John, most people, even people who think they know a little bit about the attack, have never heard of Eva Field.
Oh, yeah. It was submerged because it was incorporated into Barbers Point Naval Air Station in 1952 when the base closed. The Marine aircraft went over to Kaneohe.
Mm-hmm.
So the Marine history was pretty much eliminated from most people. And then it got sort of historically worse because the Navy made Eva Field a naval air station, not officially, but a designated naval air station in 1942, and even incorporated it into Barbers Point Naval Air Station as well. So the whole history got shifted over to Barbers Point, and Eva Field just was largely forgotten for literally decades.
Well, John, it does look as if at Marine Corps Air Station Eva, on the morning of December 7th, there was a pretty heroic effort at resistance, yeah?
Well, they did what they could. They had, people don't realize at the time, there was no anti-aircraft guns or anything. All they had, keep in mind that they had just sent off their best planes and pilots to Midway and Wake Island. Wake was later overrun later that day by Japanese invasions. So it actually took about 20 days, I think. So their best planes were gone, best pilots. These were mostly just mechanics who were getting ready to sit down for Sunday morning breakfast, and they had nothing but 1908 Springfield rifles, very, very old, bolt-action rifles. That's the only thing they had, but a few had 45 pistols and a couple of Thompson submachine guns around, but that took a while just to find ammunition for them.
Not much use against fighter aircraft, right?
No. Some people believe they shot down maybe one or two, but no one can prove it because there was so much bullets flying in every direction, including from the Taylor and Welch P-40s. And then what happened was the people over at Pearl Harbor, once they saw the Japanese planes regrouping over Eva Field, which was their regrouping point, all fired at Eva Field. So there was incoming 50 caliber and 5-inch shells and everything falling all over the place out in Eva. So it was incredibly well shot up. The Japanese emptied all their machine guns into the cars out here. Fortunately, there was not a large loss of life, amazingly enough. Two civilians from the incoming artillery, and then three Marines killed directly in combat, and one killed indirectly.
What it speaks to, John, is just how comprehensive the Pearl Harbor attack was. It approached the island from all sides, neutralized a potential responding aircraft on the ground. I mean, it was a military masterpiece.
Oh, it was. In fact, the U.S. has studied the attack on Pearl Harbor for decades in war colleges and everything because it was by far the largest. It included six aircraft carriers. So to coordinate six aircraft carriers and all the takeoffs and landings was a huge task in itself, and then they have a huge number of airplanes in the air and try to coordinate them, which the Japanese did have difficulty with that. There was a number of false mistakes that they made, but overall they were incredibly lucky because of the U.S. being totally asleep and the weather being generally in their favor and so forth. So it wound up being a very good day for the Japanese and a well-planned attack.
Well, it's a great story. Thanks very much for talking with us, John.
Okay, thanks for letting me speak about it. Thank you.
Historian John Bond will take part in a Japanese Culture Center of Hawaii event this Saturday, Remembering History, Hono Uli Uli and Eva Field. The event runs from 10:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. It's free and open to the public, and you can get details on our Facebook page.
I'm Ryan Ozawa.
And I'm Bert Lum.
Today on Bite Marks Cafe, we'll get an update on Creative Lab Hawaii and its immersive programs and ideation workshops.
Brian Cohn, writer, director, and producer of the Hawaii-based film Kuleana, will also join us to share his experiences with the program.
That's today at 6:30 p.m. on Bite Marks Cafe.
Over the next few days, we'll be looking at pocketbook issues. We sat down with Hawaii's Insurance Commissioner Gordon Ito recently. He's been on a mission. It's Ito's job to scrutinize the rate hikes when healthcare companies ask for an adjustment. Are those premium hikes warranted or not? But Ito thinks that's not enough. He's grabbed a bullhorn to warn about the rate at which healthcare premiums are rising. Here's why he says you should be worried.
Every 10 years, Hawaii's healthcare premium doubles, and the underlying reason why is because the healthcare cost continues to rise. And really, the doubling every 10 years is not sustainable. I mean, currently, Hawaii's average healthcare premium is about $650 a month. And I like to mention that, like, for homeowners, the average premium is about $700 a month, right? And healthcare premiums at $700 a month, it's per person, right? And In 8 years in a chart that I developed, I mean, I project if we continue the way we've done the last 30 years or 40 years, in 2026, the average total annual premium is going to be about $14,000 per person. For a family of four, it's going to be $42,500. We need to do something to address the rising healthcare costs, which is the underlying reason why healthcare premiums continue to increase.
And that is astounding, $42,000.
Yes, this really is not sustainable. And Hawaii's, we've been very fortunate because in 1974, we passed the Prepaid Health Care Act, which has contributed to making Hawaii the healthiest state and which has helped employees in their health care premiums because the law, the max employer can take out of a person's wage is 1.5%. So in the context of an average wage, say, in Hawaii, the average income is $50,000. 1.5% is $750. That's the max contribution an employee provides. The employers are picking up about 11 months of premiums. And my biggest fear is if we don't control the healthcare costs, the entire healthcare system in Hawaii is going to collapse, including a potential repeal of the Prepaid Healthcare Act. Or what may likely happen also as an alternative is the benefits that we have in our healthcare policies right now is going to get reduced. The analogy I kind of use is when we go to the grocery stores, I mean, we look at a box of cereal and the price might be the same, but the contents is less, right? So that's what may start happening with our healthcare policy and the benefits we receive. I mean, the benefits might start getting reduced to keep the price down.
Right, and you raise that point about going to the grocery store and seeing it because we are seeing more of that. You know, the a gallon of ice cream is no longer a gallon anymore, but the price, you know, smaller containers. You said smaller packages of cereal, so visually, it's a good way to drive that home.
Right. And just to put things into context, I mean, in terms of the total premiums in Hawaii, in 2016, the total premiums written in Hawaii for property and casualty, like your homeowner's auto, life insurance, the total premiums written was about $4.3 billion. The total written premium in Hawaii on healthcare alone was $7 billion, almost twice as much as P&C and life and annuities combined. And just in 2016, again, to put it into context, I mean, when I looked at the insurance commissioner's report, in 2006, the total healthcare premiums was about $3 billion. So in that 10 years, it went from $3 billion written premium in Hawaii to $7 billion, you know, again, showing the doubling effect.
And then talk about the costs of diseases that are very expensive to treat. We have a high rate of diabetes here in the islands, also kidney disease. It's just, you know, talk about those costs.
Yeah. So, you know, there's the high cost drivers, and we've identified many of them. Obesity in Hawaii, just in terms of some statistics, in 1994 to 2015, our obesity rate in Hawaii went from 10% to 23%. Overweight went from, or obese went from 41% to 57%. Another area that ends up causing heart disease as well as kidney disease in terms of hypertension or high blood pressure, I mean, it, in that same time period, went from 24% to 32% of our people in Hawaii had hypertension. And diabetes went from 4.2% to 8.5%. So that's kind of the things we need to address. When I say we need to bend the cost curve, we need to start addressing some of the health of the citizens in Hawaii. We need to turn this trend around and reduce obesity and hypertension and diabetes, because those, as well as heart disease, those are the chronic conditions, acute conditions that take a lot of money out of the healthcare system.
Right, and the numbers here are really staggering when you talk about, you know, doubling the percentage of folks that might have diabetes, as well as the cost, because it's very expensive if you're on dialysis, if it gets to that point, but really staggering costs.
Yeah, and just to mention some costs, I mean, in terms of diabetes, in one study, it estimated one in two adults have type 2 diabetes or are pre-diabetic. And in 2014, it was estimated that the spend on treating diabetes in Hawaii was $1.5 billion, or about $1 for every $5 of healthcare spent is on diabetes. And that's in one study. So the cost is just staggering.
Right, and we are seeing a number of the organizations focus on prevention. You know, Kaiser, HMSA, lots of folks just saying, look, you've got to, you know, get away from the sugary drinks and, you know, changing the lifestyle habits and putting the emphasis on prevention rather than, you know, the poor outcomes at the end of the day if you've got one of these chronic diseases.
Yeah, so many, if not all, health insurers are, you know, encouraging wellness, trying to really turn this trend around, as well as Department of Health, I mean, and DHS. I mean, they're doing tremendous things, I mean, great things and things in terms of trying to things around. But it really starts from you and I in making a commitment to start making little changes, you know, take small steps. I mean, for me personally, the thing that motivated me was I bought a little fitness tracker thing, and it motivated me to start walking. And just the other night, I got a notification, and within 2 years, I walked 8 million steps.
Oh,
right?
Congratulations. So, better mean, than me.
It's just little things like that. I mean, just eat less, just take little steps at a time. And if we all do it, I think we can start turning this trend around.
Right. So it's everybody doing their part. Your office tries to keep the premiums
premiums down as much, but we only can do so much, because the law requires that rates can't be excessive, inadequate, or unfairly discriminatory. And people could say, yes, healthcare premiums are excessive already, right? But when they say excessive or inadequate, it's a fiscal basis. So the example I'd like to give is, in the ACA individual, as a hypothetical, you know, there's been tremendous increases. And if on a yearly basis, say, an insurer only collects or charges $1 million or collects $1 million in premium, $100 million in premium, but it pays out $120 million in premium, that rate that they're charging to get $100 million in premium is inadequate. because they're losing $20 million. So just to break even, they have to raise the rates 20% to break even, right? And by law, we can't approve a rate that's inadequate because then you have solvency issues for health insurance.
Yeah, so what's your greatest fear at the end of the day? We're faced with these costs. You're sounding the alarm. Look, we need to pay attention. This is simply just not sustainable.
Yeah. So, my biggest fear is there's an impact on Hawaii's prepaid health care law, whether it's a repeal, I hate to say that, or there's really a reduction in health care benefits. I mean, because our health plans are extremely rich. I mean, we have a lot of benefits as compared to many other states.
So in that point in regard, Hawaii, we're fortunate.
We're very fortunate. And so my biggest fear, again, is if the benefits are reduced or there's an impact on prepaid, then it's going to trickle throughout the entire healthcare system where you're going to have a lot of uncompensated care. If you don't have this coverage and you go to a hospital and you need some kind of medical attention and it's not covered, then you're going to have to pay it out of your pocket, right? And if you can't, then the hospitals will lose money because it's uncompensated care. So it's going to have a ripple effect throughout our entire health system, and that's what I'm trying to prevent. I mean, that's what many of us are trying to prevent, and we really need to redouble efforts to really bend the cost curve.
That was State Insurance Commissioner Gordon Ito sounding the call for us to pay attention to what's happening with healthcare and the fears that he has about what could result if we don't do something to curb those costs. I'm Catherine Cruz, and this is The Conversation.
Aloha, I'm Chip Fletcher from the University of Hawaii School of Ocean and Earth Science and Technology, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
In today's backyard quiz, they're not as glamorous as some local endangered critters, but the state has a lab dedicated to keeping alive the species that remain in our islands. It was started under the University of Hawaii, and we were told that it is now in the hands of the Department of Land and Natural Resources. The state website says the tree snails are not only aesthetically important and evolutionarily informative, they are considered flagship species. Their presence in the wild indicates pristine, intact forest habitats, largely free of invasive predators and plants. Native forests are critical to human population health downslope as they act as critical natural rainwater filtration and catchment systems for island watersheds. Rain, mist, and condensation drip from tree leaves and plants to spongy mosses and soils, where they're held acting as reserves that recharge water resources. Without upland native forests, the rivers and aquifers that supply our plentiful clean water would wither and dry up. Those are the words of the Hawaiian Tree Snail Conservation Lab, and Hawaiian tree snail is the answer we were looking for.
And Catherine Stan from Kailua was the first of several people to give us the correct answer to this. Congratulations, Stan. That's today's quiz. If you've got one, you can send it to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. Edward Lyman has decades of experience in a rare specialty. He's the Hawaiian Islands Humpback Whale National Marine Sanctuary's Large Whale Entanglement Response Coordinator, with more than 100 disentanglements to his credit. He does it using techniques adapted from earlier practices of fishermen and whalers, techniques that in the past were designed to kill the 40-ton marine mammals rather than save them. He'll be giving a talk tomorrow evening at the Maui Ocean Center, and he's on the line with us now. Good morning, Ed.
Morning, Chris. How you doing?
Great. Thanks for talking with us.
No worries. My pleasure.
I congratulate you for having the longest job title I've run into in quite some time.
I know. Sorry about that one.
I get out of breath just getting to the end. But how did you get into this specialty?
Yeah, again, years ago, and I was just actually a boat captain and maybe the right place at the right time back east, northeast, and a couple pioneers in the field of cutting these whales free asked me to lend a hand, and that's how it all started.
What does it take? I mean, you've got an animal that's in a lot of distress, and it's huge, and is probably resistant to some of your efforts. How do you go about it?
Exactly, Chris. Yeah, they don't always realize, and probably almost always don't realize that you're there to help them. So we have to get a little control on the animals. And the title to at the Maui Ocean Center talk is Catch and Release. And it kind of gives a little bit away. It's a little catchy, sorry for a pun there, as well. But we're actually trying to grab the animal via the entanglement, slow it down a little bit, give it a little control, have some control over what is a 40-ton animal by adding more gear to get all the rest of the gear off.
You're putting restraints, physical restraints around the animal?
Exactly. You made reference to the old whaling technique. It was called kegging, and they added wooden barrels. What we're doing is adding poly balls, buoys, to keep the whale towards the surface or at the surface, maybe slow it down a little bit, and then that line that we're holding on to literally, maybe from a small boat, and we can pull up behind the whale and then use hook knives to cut it free. And those same buoys that slow the whale down now keep the gear afloat, and we pull it out of the water and figure out what it was.
I think kegging is referred to at some point in Moby Dick, where you attach these barrels to the whale so it has to be at the surface and available to you, right? That's how they completed the kill. Is that accurate?
Exactly. This is right out of Moby Dick, the old, you know, the historic whaling. Tall ships, wooden skiffs, very similar in that regard.
There were so many in the height of the whaling era. There were so many whales around, weren't there? I mean, it was a huge population. It was
exactly.
Once they got among a group of whales, they could bring in, what, like 15, 20 a day sometimes.
Yep, and of course things changed over time. The speed of the vessels, the harpoons versus harpoon guns, and having factory ships, being able to stay out there and work on the animals. So things definitely, the pressure changed over time and on the different species as well over time.
It's great that you've been able to adapt some of those techniques to saving them, but how prevalent is the problem of whales getting entangled in some kind of netting? And what kind of netting is it that gets them?
Gotcha, Chris. Well, you know, as far as how big of a threat this is, we don't know exactly. That's one of the goals here. One of the main goals is just to figure out just exactly what the overall impact is. But it is a big one. I mean, there's one number that's already over a decade old, but it was very scientifically based, and this is going to be for all whales, okay, porpoises, dolphins, and it's going to be worldwide. But 308,000 fall victim to entanglement threat each year worldwide, and that's going to be an underestimate because that's the problem here. Even a 45-foot whale is a very big needle in a very big haystack out there in the world's oceans, and they carry the gear away with them, so it's hard to pick up that information.
I just have to think that their suffering has got to be pretty intense.
It is. It's long-term. I mean, that's, again, with the large whales, the threat is typically not immediate. They rip the gear off the ocean floor, whatever it might be. And it's, by the way, it's not always fishing gear. You asked what the gear might be. It's anything and everything out there in the water column. They rip it off the ocean floor. They swim off with it. And it may be months to years before the animal falls victim to that threat, to the entanglement threat.
So it might have some netting already on its body and which is not bothering it until it gets bigger, and then it starts to limit its movement, something like that?
That is one thing that we want to assess, because, you know, the flip side of this is some whales or many whales get entangled and the entanglement is not life-threatening, and that they will throw that gear over time. In fact, that title again of Catch and Release also makes reference to that as well, as the fact that maybe the whales get caught and release themselves. And our job is to figure out when that report comes in, is that entanglement a life-threatening entanglement? Is it a full wrap that the whale is not likely to throw off on its own?
A full wrap meaning its body is entirely encircled by netting?
Exactly. And that's one of the cues, one of the criteria we have is full wraps, how tight it might be, the age of the animal, youngsters, and you made reference to this, Chris, they can grow into the gear. So we prioritize a calf or a sub-adult, a juvenile, if you will, because of the fact that it will grow into the gear. And tight it is, what type of gear it might be, how strong it is. All those are important aspects of our program, and so much of this is based on assessment. We're sort of the whale doctors out there, the sanctuary and the partners we work with,
mm-hmm.
and trying to figure out what's going on, what are the threats.
I'm guessing that you could use a lot of help in this area, and it'd be good to have a lot more people doing the kind of this kind of work out there. Is that right?
Exactly, Chris. But at the same time, we have to have the right people for the right roles.
Mm-hmm.
We get an immense amount of help. I have to really shout out to the whole community because they really are, especially the on-water community. They're the foundation of the effort. They work right with us, and everything from finding these animals, I made reference to the fact that they're a large needle in a large haystack.
Mm-hmm.
They report, and they're assessing and documenting, getting that initial information, and standing by. We had a response just late last week, a two-day effort. There was a boat just out there cruising and came across the entangled whale and stood by for us for several hours overall.
Mm-hmm.
That's incredible to make sure we didn't lose that whale before the first response team arrived on site. So many roles to play, but we do ask that, you don't, people as well-intentioned as it is, don't try to free the whales on their own.
Oh, no, I would think that would be a reason to hesitate. But, what this describes, Ed, is a real change. And when you consider that, a century and a half ago, we were killing every one of these we saw, this is a welcome change, isn't it?
It is. It's such a privilege. I mean, working with everyone here in Hawaii and it's such a team effort, and it's very, very rewarding, I must say.
Well, it's good to have that job, Ed. Stick with it. And thanks very much for talking with us.
Will do, Chris, and thank you.
My pleasure. Edward Lyman is the Hawaiian Islands Humpback Whale National Marine Sanctuary's Large Whale Entanglement Response Coordinator. He's giving a talk about his work tomorrow evening at 6 p.m. at the Maui Ocean Center in Wailuku. It's free and open to the public, and you can learn more about it on our Facebook page.
Hi, I'm Lisa Yamada-san from Flux Hawaii Magazine. Hear the conversation live or anytime you want on the HPR mobile app. Find it in the Apple Store or Google Play.
And that's it for today's edition of The Conversation. Tomorrow, former Governor John Wahei gives us his thoughts on the recent audit of the Office of Hawaiian Affairs.
Tell us what you think or suggest a story idea. Call our talkback line. Leave us your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
You can find us on Facebook at The Conversation, on Twitter at HI Conversation. This program and all our past ones are available on the Conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.